but now you're trying to do that with maybe running at 75% of your normal staffing.
Now that the shutdown is over, federal workers who track the economy are back at work, but we'll have to wait for concrete numbers.
For Thursday, November 13th, it's All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Scott Detrow. A Sudanese journalist describes the devastation to her hometown after the paramilitary Rapid Support Forces seized it.
What we say in Arabic, that nice people, they don't live long. He was one of the people who, like, tried to find food to the people who are dying from hunger.
Also, a roundup of our favorite science stories of the week, including the secrets behind the eye movements of chameleons.
They have fused fingers for grasping onto branches. They have all the color change stuff. They have a ballistic tongue.
And how big of a problem is grade inflation at universities?
Now news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Ryland Barton. President Trump says he's turning his attention to affordability now that the government shutdown is over. As NPR's Tamara Keith reports, polls show voters are concerned about the economy and cost of living.
A senior administration official not authorized to speak on the record tells NPR Trump will soon travel around the country with a message that while some things have improved, there's still more work to do to help people feeling economic strain. And that was part of Trump's messaging last night at the White House.
My administration and our partners in Congress will continue our work to lower the cost of living, restore public safety, grow our economy, and make America affordable again for all Americans. Again, costs are way down.
Inflation has been persistent so far this year, which has voters in a foul mood about the economy. Tamara Keith, NPR News.
The government shutdown has ended without a solution for spiking health insurance premiums. Democrats had demanded that Republicans restore subsidies for the premiums to win their support for the spending bill to end the shutdown, but that didn't happen. NPR's Selena Simmons Duffin reports that means the 24 million people enrolled in Affordable Care Act plans are in a difficult situation.
Enhanced premium subsidies that have kept costs down for enrollees expire at the end of the year. Without them, costs are going up. For Amy Jackson of Butler, Missouri, her premium is going from under $300 a month to $1,250. She's not sure congressional lawmakers understand.
You know, for them, $1,000 is probably nothing. It's probably what they blow on dinner. But for me, that's half of my wage. You know, I just can't swing that.
She has breast cancer and is trying to get as much treatment as possible into this calendar year. She's been calling her representatives and telling them that people like her need help now. Selena Simmons Duffin, NPR News, Washington.
California officials say they plan to revoke 17,000 commercial driver's licenses given to immigrants after discovering the expiration dates went past when the drivers were legally allowed to be in the U.S. The announcement follows harsh criticism from the Trump administration about California and other states granting licenses to people who are in the country illegally.
Lift up, detector.
Jeff Bezos' Blue Origin company launched its football field-long New Glenn rocket today with a pair of NASA spacecraft destined for Mars. It was only the second flight of the rocket that NASA is counting on to get people and supplies to the moon. Blue Origin recovered the booster following its separation from the upper stage and the Mars orbiters, an essential step to recycle and slash costs similar to SpaceX. The U.S. stock market tumbled to one of its worst days since this spring. You're listening to NPR News from Washington. Jeff Bezos. The BBC has apologized to President Trump over a misleading edit in a documentary about the January 6 insurrection. The BBC's chair, Samir Shah, sent a letter saying he and the corporation were sorry for the edit of Trump's speech before some of his supporters stormed the U.S. Capitol. But the broadcaster says there is no basis for Trump's threat for a $1 billion lawsuit. A new study finds eating more ultra-processed foods is linked to a greater risk of pre-diabetes in young adults. As NPR's Maria Godoy reports, the food makes up most of what Americans eat.
Prior research has linked overconsumption of ultra-processed foods to type 2 diabetes in adults. But few studies have looked at the health effects among youth.
We don't really know what's happening with these young adults.
That's Lita Chatzi of the University of Southern California. She and her colleagues wanted to know how the diet choices of young adults influence their risk of chronic disease. So they followed 85 older adolescents with a history of overweight or obesity over 4 years.
We found something that was shocking to us.
Even a small 10% increase in consumption of ultra-processed foods was linked to a 50% higher risk of having prediabetes. That's early stage high blood sugar that can lead to diabetes down the road. Maria Godoy, NPR News.
Scientists have captured rare footage of remoras, also known as suckerfish, hitching rides on humpback whales off the coast of Australia. The footage shows the fish peeling away just before the whale breaches, then returning to the same spots with precision. You're listening to NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Sony Pictures Classics with Nuremberg, a new thriller starring Russell Crowe, Rami Malek, and Michael Shannon about the historic post-World War II trial of Nazi official Hermann Göring, now playing in theaters.
It is 4:06, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. Support comes from Headwaters Unitarian Universalist Fellowship in Bemidji, gathering at 10 a.m. on Sundays now through May at the Headwaters Peace Center. HUF is an inclusive space to seek truth, practice love, and celebrate life. Learn more at headwatersuu.org. Weather tonight, mostly clear skies, lows 29 to 34. Tomorrow, mostly sunny with highs 54 to 60 degrees.
Considered from NPR News, I'm Scott Detrow in Washington.
And I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California. Well, the government shutdown is over, but it could take a while to make up for all the economic reports that we missed over the last 6 weeks. The federal workers who keep tabs on unemployment, inflation, spending, and the like are back on the job, and once they return to their actual desks, they can get back to measuring how the U.S. economy is doing. But in the meantime, NPR's Scott Horsley joins us now to fill us in. Hey, Scott.
Hi.
Okay, so what kind of economic numbers were not released during the shutdown? And what is it going to take to fill that void?
Well, we missed the numbers on pretty much everything that government economists usually keep tabs on: jobs, prices, retail spending, GDP. The people who tabulate those numbers were furloughed during the shutdown. And, you know, now they got to get the cobwebs off their desk and try to make up for lost time. Yeah. We should get the September jobs report pretty quickly. That was almost done when the shutdown began. And we did get an inflation report for September because Social Security had to have that to calculate next year's cost of living adjustment. But so far, we have not seen reports for October on either jobs or unemployment or inflation. Omer Sharif, who runs a firm called Inflation Insight, says the unemployment numbers might be the hardest to reconstruct. You have to call thousands of people to ask what they were doing a month ago now. And even before the shutdown, the bureau that compiles that report was shorthanded because of the Trump administration's job cuts.
Even under a best case scenario, this would be really difficult to go back and collect data that's from the month of October. But now you're trying to do that with, you know, maybe running at 75% of your normal staffing.
A White House spokeswoman suggested the government might just skip some of the October reports and go straight to work on November's data. This is the week when the November jobs tally would ordinarily be conducted.
Wait, but what would it mean if some of the reports were just skipped altogether?
Well, hard to say. It's never happened before, and it's not at all clear it will happen this time. The government did skip a few minor reports after the 2013 shutdown, but we've never had a major economic indicator that was just left blank forever. Mm-hmm. Even during the early months of the pandemic, when government price checkers couldn't go out to supermarkets and scan the 40,000 grocery items they usually do, they found workarounds. And Sharif says even if the data isn't as comprehensive as usual, government number crunchers will do their best to avoid missing a major report like inflation.
It's an important data point, number one. But number two, you don't want to leave a hole in your time series. So the continuity of the data is a bit more important than, you know, ensuring like the normal level of accuracy.
Former government officials I've talked to say if there are adjustments in how the data is collected or how many people are surveyed, the government will let us know so the people who rely on these figures know what they're dealing with.
And who does rely on this data? Like, this is important stuff, right?
Oh, yeah. It informs decisions for businesses and investors. It helps the Federal Reserve decide where to set interest rates. You know, for 6 weeks, they've all had to look to other signals as they try to take the temperature of the economy. But pretty much everyone agrees there's no substitute for the reach of the federal government's numbers. It's going to take some time for government number crunchers to get back in the groove, so economic reports are likely to be delayed for probably the rest of the year. But Nancy Vandenhouten, who's with the forecasting firm Oxford Economics, says that's not the end of the world.
I mean, sure, it'll make it challenging at what is a bit of an uncertain time anyway, but I think we'll be able to piece it together. And, you know, as we look to early next year, the regular data flow should be on track.
She says there were a lot of other hardships caused by the shutdown that were worse, and some of those may eventually show up in the government data.
That is NPR's Scott Horsley. Thank you, Scott.
You're welcome.
The House of Representatives came back for one day this week after being gone for more than 50. During the government shutdown, the House was officially out of session. Some members did town halls back in their districts. Others came to the Capitol anyway. But as NPR's Barbara Sprunt reports, there was angst on all sides when everyone reassembled.
The House Rules Committee met earlier this week ahead of the full House coming back into session on Wednesday. And let's just say things were tense. Here's Jim McGovern, the top Democrat on the panel.
Long time no see. I hardly recognize you guys. Where the hell have you been?
After repeated comments from Democrats about Republicans being on vacation during the shutdown, Chairwoman Virginia Fox stepped in.
I am sick and tired of hearing you all say we had an 8-week vacation.
That's exactly what happened.
I worked every day. I don't know about you, but I don't want to hear another soul say that.
We all worked every single day.
The House passed its version of a stopgap funding bill in mid-September. House Speaker Mike Johnson then sent lawmakers home. He was asked on the third day of the shutdown, why not stay?
My quick answer is very simple. The House did its job.
Then he blamed Democratic leaders in the Senate for not doing theirs. Leadership on both sides of the aisle held press conferences almost every day of the shutdown, but there were no votes, no committee hearings. Wednesday was the first official day back in 54 days.
It's a lot more crowded here. You know, the halls have been pretty lonely.
That's California Republican Kevin Kiley. He kept showing up to his Capitol office throughout the shutdown.
To be honest with you, this has not been the finest hour for the United States Congress. Having the House of Representatives cancel its sessions while so many people across the country were suffering.
He said he used the time to work with a colleague on the other side of the aisle to address an extension of Affordable Care Act subsidies that are set to expire at the end of the year. Those subsidies were central to the shutdown.
That was, I guess, one advantage of being here is that I have had some constructive conversations like that. But of course, if the entire House was here, then we could have been having the sort of consensus building process that you need to pass legislation like this.
Fellow Republican Mark Alford of Missouri said the time back home was useful.
Look, I've been here for 3 years. I got more done in my district than I think in the 3 years that I've been there. I've been able to visit farms. We went to businesses. We visited 14 of our 18 rural hospitals in our district. And it gave us a real clear picture of where America stands right now and what we can do to help.
Meanwhile, Democrats are still fuming that the House was even sent home at all.
This was a ridiculous thing.
That's Julie Johnson, a freshman Democrat from Texas.
I think that the speaker really has exuded some poor judgment, and it was disrespectful to the body. And then the speaker refusing to swear in a duly elected, that was poor form.
She's referring to Arizona Democrat Adelita Grijalva, who won a special election in mid-September, but wasn't sworn in until yesterday, before any votes. The common refrain from Democrats, like New Mexico's Melanie Stansbury, is this.
The House has been completely closed and locked out, and there is all manner of legislative business that could have been going on, and we should have been here the entire time.
Republican Steve Womack of Arkansas says he agrees with that.
Listen, I didn't want to go home in August. So to be gone for those 5 or 6 weeks and then turn around and do it again in October was just, that's just more than America should have to put up with.
He's a senior appropriator, and he's now looking down the road at what lies ahead.
We're going to be putting Congress on the clock again. In another 78, 79 days, we're going to be right back where we were. I just hope we don't put America back through this same nut roll.
Funding for much of the government will run out again January 30th. Barbara Sprunt, NPR News, the Capitol.
Okay, movie fans who are impatient for, say, the release of Frozen 3 or the next installment of the Star Wars franchise might soon be able to create their own mini versions. At least that's what Disney CEO Bob Iger hinted at on an earnings call today. Here to talk about it is NPR's Chloe Veltman. Hi, Chloe.
Hi, Elsa.
Wait, so what's going on here? What did Iger say exactly?
Well, I mean, to be clear, the Disney CEO didn't make any firm announcements today, but he did talk about a few interesting ideas the company companies exploring, including potentially collaborating with AI companies.
AI is going to give us the ability to provide users of Disney Plus with a much more engaged experience, including the ability for them to create user-generated content.
Now, Iger didn't elaborate on exactly what this user-generated content might look like, and Disney Plus did not supply more details and via email when I wrote to them. But Iger says it would give Disney Plus consumers the opportunity to create content and share it with others.
Wait, I'm trying to picture this. So are like tons of Toy Story and Iron Man mashups going to be coming to our screen soon? Like, I mean, how will Disney stop misuses of its intellectual property?
Well, Elsa, it's probably going to be a balancing act. Iger said the talks Disney has been having with these AI companies are focused both on looking for ways to use the technologies to create more consumer engagement. At the same time, it's important that they protect the value of the company's IP. And Elsa, Disney isn't the only company thinking about ways to make content more interactive using new technologies.
Oh, really? What else are you seeing out there?
Well, I attended the TechCrunch Startup Conference in San Francisco a couple of weeks ago, and there was quite a bit of talk about this. Huh. Here's Netflix's Chief Technology Officer, Elizabeth Stone.
The future of entertainment is likely to be even more personalized, even more interactive, even more immersive.
Interactive. So what does Stone say about how this future content might look?
She said several things, but one thing that really is capturing a lot of attention, including mine, she said Netflix users will be able to interact with the upcoming reboot of the Star Search talent show when it launches next year.
Okay.
So if you're sitting at home watching Star Search on your TV, you'll be able to either on the TV or your mobile phone actually put in a vote that advances or doesn't advance some of the contestants on the show.
Yeah, neat, huh?
This, of course,
is all in addition to the standard movie and TV watching people do on the platform.
Well, that's the thing, Chloe. I like regular old movies and TV shows. Aren't they enough? Like, why are companies such as Disney and Netflix so interested in moving towards interactivity?
Well, two words for you, Elsa. Gen Z. User-generated content is huge with this demographic in particular.
Young people,
and according to Deloitte's 2025 Digital Media Trends Survey, more than half of these people say this type of user-generated content is more relevant to them than traditional TV content like TV shows and movies. So, yeah, and another reason is that entertainment companies are starting to get more comfortable with making deals with tech companies.
All right, that is NPR's Chloe Veltman. Thank you so much, Chloe.
A pleasure, Elsa.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
It is 4:18, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE-KBXE. Coming up next is your Daily Dose of Phenology, where John Latimer looks back at his nature notes from the state. After Dark is KAXE's Saturday night program after Green Cheese from 9 to midnight, featuring styles of music like punk, metal, R&B, hip-hop, and more. This week's host is Jay Steelwolf, playing heavy metal. Interested in hosting? Email dgannon@kaxe.org.
On today's date, November 13th, in the year 2006, I get a report from a friend who lives on the Sherry's Arm portion of Pakegama Lake of a single common loon hanging out in the waters there. Loons typically migrate a little bit earlier than this, and the adults much earlier than the juveniles. The adults gather on area lakes and fly over to Lake Michigan and spend the couple of weeks, maybe 3 weeks in Lake Michigan, and then turn and head south and end up in the Gulf of Mexico after a two-day journey. But the juveniles, and this may have been a juvenile because they are among the last to leave the area, the juveniles take a rather circuitous route to the Gulf of Mexico, one that was radio tagged by a crew that I was a part of, spent most of its migration wandering back and forth across the Mississippi River, first Illinois and then Missouri and then back into Kentucky and then across to Louisiana, but finally ending up in the Gulf of Mexico. So these late leaving loons are often juveniles, and given the fact that they have no instructions, and no clear pattern, they oftentimes are a bit trepidatious about the trip.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from Fisher Investments. Fisher is committed to helping clients stay on track to reach their financial goals and enjoy a comfortable retirement. FisherInvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. From Easy Cater, designed to help organizations order food for meetings and events from a nationwide network of restaurants, create lunch programs for their employees, and manage food spend at EasyCater.com. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Ailsa Chang.
And I'm Scott Detrow. It is time now for our science news roundup from Shortwave, NPR's science podcast. And we have the show's two hosts here, Regina Barber and Emily Kwong. Hello.
Hey. Hi, Scott.
You have, as you do, brought us three stories from the world of science. What are they?
A map of the AI energy crisis. And good news for an ocean moon of Saturn. And a new discovery about chameleons.
Since it seems the least joyous, let's start with AI computing. We talk a lot about AI these days, and there's a lot of concern about the power it's sucking up.
Yeah, it truly. A lot of AI computing relies on data centers. Data centers are these big buildings which gobble up gigawatts of energy, sometimes millions of gallons of water for cooling. And as tech companies try to make good on AI's potential, there is an energy crisis in the making.
How so?
Well, because the majority of these data centers are powered by fossil fuels. Tianqi Shao is a PhD candidate at Cornell University, and he says that if the tech industry and policymakers are not careful, the boom in AI will jeopardize our climate progress.
The monitoring will be much important in the next few years, because before we know the whole picture, and we may already do something very bad for our environment.
So this week in the journal Nature Sustainability, Tianqi's team at Cornell published a state-by-state portrait of the environmental impact of AI, and this map took 3 years to make.
3 years? What did it tell us? Was it worth the wait?
Well, using data analytics and, ironically, some AI, the team determined that by 2030, at the rate of AI growth in the U.S. would put an additional 24 to 44 million metric tons of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. And the team said it could use as much water as 6 to 10 million Americans do every year. All of this, the paper concludes, would put the tech industry's climate goals out of reach.
Can you remind me what those initial goals were or are?
Yeah, so Google, Microsoft, and Meta have all pledged to reach net zero carbon emissions and to be water positive by 2030. Amazon has set their net zero carbon deadline for 2040. But according to this paper, AI is putting all of those climate goals in peril. We reached out to these companies. Google didn't reply, and the others declined to comment.
I mean, I'm hearing this, and I'm feeling sad and discouraged.
Yeah, me too. Don't. Never.
Is that the right feeling?
Never despair, Scott, ever. Because a big part of this study is about solutions. The biggest takeaway is location. Study author Fengqi Yu says where you build a data center matters.
If we build AI in the right place, on a clean power grid and with efficient cooling technology, it could really grow without blowing past climate and water limits.
Fengqi wants data centers built in places with low water stress that are already transitioning to clean energy. So spots in the Midwest and Windbelt states like Texas, Montana, Nebraska, and South Dakota are good candidates. And big tech has been scouting future data centers in some of these states.
This still makes me anxious and worried, and I think it's time to change the topic to an ocean moon, which I would much rather talk about.
What a pivot. Well, me too. Me too, Scott.
Off Earth.
I know you love space,
I do.
You might remember that Saturn has 274 confirmed moons, right?
Confirmed moons.
Yeah, and one of those moons is Enceladus, and it's really intriguing to scientists looking for life elsewhere in the solar system because it has an ocean covering its entire surface that's locked under a thick layer of ice, and scientists say it could be a good potential spot for life.
It looks like all the right ingredients are there for it. All it needs is time.
That's Georgina Miles with the Southwest Research Institute in Colorado. And the ingredients for life she's talking about are liquid water, chemicals like hydrogen, oxygen, nitrogen, and carbon.
And in a new paper in the journal Science Advances, she and her colleagues write about another important ingredient, a heating source.
Which feels pretty important for life, huh?
Yeah, turns out because if the temperatures in the ocean fluctuate too much or too hot or too cold, that's not good for life. You want a stable heat flow process. And overall, this study found that
that the heat flow seems to be pretty consistent on Enceladus.
And that means that the ocean on Enceladus is very stable. It is now and probably has been for most of the moon's existence.
Which I assume is another good ingredient for what we're talking about here.
Yeah, it's promising because life takes a really long time to begin and develop. Here's Carly Howitt, another author of the study and fellow planetary scientist.
We know that evolution is a slow process, but we're hopeful if it started on Enceladus, there might be something for us to see today.
Something for us to see today. Does that mean we're going there? Are we sending robots there? What's the situation?
Not NASA, but okay. The European Space Agency may. Carly and Georgina are based in the UK, and the European Space Agency is proposing a mission to Enceladus in the 2040s.
But there is a NASA mission going to another promising moon of Saturn, Titan. It's set to launch in 2028, which is really soon. This moon has mountains of ice and methane lakes. The lander on this mission, Dragonfly, will do close-up measurements of a Titan surface.
Okay, that's interesting.
Yeah.
Can we also talk about chameleons? And can I make a request? My three-year-old daughter has recently started calling chameleons colorful lizards.
They are.
It's true.
They're part of a clade called Old World Lizards.
Yeah.
And they are incredibly colorful and funky.
Yeah. And Scott, let me also start with this like stone cold, like this universal truth about these colorful lizards, these chameleons.
Every aspect of them is weird.
This is Ed Stanley, an evolutionary biologist at the Florida Museum of Natural History.
They have fused fingers for grasping onto branches. They have all the color change stuff. They have a ballistic tongue. Their body shape is absolutely bizarre, right? Most lizards are short and wide. These ones are incredibly thin and tall.
And there's another trait to add to the list. They've got really weird optic nerves. Okay, so optic nerves, that's the bundle of nerve fibers that send information between the eyes and the brain. In lizards, they're more straight, but in chameleons, those optic nerves are coiled.
In shortwave and all things considered, we love weirdos.
Yeah.
It's very true.
Three of them are in this room.
Yes.
But in terms of our chameleon friends, why does all this weirdness matter?
Okay, so researchers suspect it could help chameleons move their eyes in those like strange twisty ways. I'm sure you've seen this before, Scott, like when one eye of a chameleon is like moving independently from the other, like maybe one is looking at an insect for lunch and the other one's looking at another chameleon.
Chameleons can even look backwards. So it's really bizarre for an animal.
What?
Right? Okay, this is Juan Daza. He's one of the study authors, and he compared the coils of their optic nerve to those old landline telephone cords.
Oh.
We discovered at some point that if you made this cord twisted, you can have more range of movement.
Like, remember the days when the phone would be in the kitchen and you could walk into the living room?
So your mom couldn't hear you.
Yeah, you didn't want that. Maybe the coil in the optic nerves of chameleons is what allows their eyes to go all catawampus like that.
I mean, I'm kind of surprised this is all new information. We've all been loving chameleons for a long time.
Yeah. Yeah. And scientists have dissected them. They've looked at chameleons, but that's probably why we didn't know this. So, like, dissections can damage the optic nerve.
Mm-hmm.
Researchers in this study used CT scans, which allowed them to get a 3D view of the chameleon's internal structures without destroying the optic nerve. They wrote about it this week in the journal Scientific Reports.
That is Regina Barber and Emily Kwong, two weirdos who host NPR's science podcast, yep. Shortwave. You can follow it on the NPR app or on your podcast platform of choice. Thank you to you both.
Thank you.
Bye, Scott.
And a note that Google, Microsoft, and Amazon are financial supporters of NPR.
This is NPR News.
Filmmaker Ken Burns is known for examining the events that define American history. Now, he turns his lens toward what he calls one of the most significant events in human history.
There was a kind of energy and frisson as we were developing the film, and you began to realize this is a really big deal.
Burns on his 10-year project to tell the story of the American Revolution. That's tomorrow on Morning Edition from NPR News.
It is 4:29, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE, KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. Coming up next is National Native News. We receive support from the Move It Real Estate Group, assisting clients with real estate purchases and sales for over 25 years, not only in Grand Rapids, but across northern Minnesota. Move to what moves you. More at moveitrealestate.com. The Symphony Orchestra presents Pathway to Dignity Sunday, November 16th at 3 p.m. at the Bemidji High School Auditorium. They will be accepting donations of new or gently used gloves, socks, hats, and scarves that will be distributed to several nonprofit organizations. Take part in community read-in at the Bemidji Public Library from 5 to 6 p.m. Mondays in November. Gather to read quietly together, demonstrate support, and celebrate the library. Coats for the Community will distribute winter gear for those in need Tuesday, November 18th from 5 to 7 at St. Peter's Catholic Church in Park Rapids.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. A new study aims to shed light on the hidden impacts of domestic violence in Native communities. The Mountain West News Bureau's Daniel Spalding reports on the effort to understand the unrecognized brain injuries many survivors are living with.
The Urban Indian Health Institute survey aims to find out how common traumatic brain injuries are among Native survivors of domestic and sexual violence. More than 80% of Indigenous women have experienced violence in their lifetime. According to Abigail Echohawk, the Institute's director, many survivors of domestic and sexual violence suffer from brain injuries that never get diagnosed or receive proper care.
They deserve justice, they deserve safety, and they deserve to get the treatment that they need when they've been impacted by traumatic brain injury.
The goal of the survey is to ensure survivors get the right care and support through programs and policies designed to help them heal. The survey began in October and will remain open through January 2026. I'm Daniel Spalding.
A nonprofit has released a new UPIC glossary with behavioral health terms. UPIC speakers, including those affected by the recent Western Alaska storm, which devastated communities, can use it to communicate with their health providers and to understand their mental health better. Ayulna Naiden with the Alaska Desk has more.
Last month, Moses Mahak Wiseman was helping with UPIC translation at the Anchorage shelters that hosted evacuees from the recent Western Alaska storm. He was also sharing a new glossary with UPIC words for behavioral health terms.
When you have a culture of your own that's not a part of American culture, it's a taboo thing to talk about behavioral health and mental health care. So like having this available when it was available, it's just an ease of mind, I think.
Wiseman is the Alaska Native Languages Program Director at the Alaska Institute for Justice. Last month, the nonprofit released a new glossary. People can type in a modern health-related term,
self-stigma,
and listen to its UPIC pronunciation.
Shminik Gazmukluni.
Wiseman says it should help UPIC interpreters and service providers to break down language barriers and help people understand their health better. Indra Arriaga is the strategic and operational director at the Institute for Justice.
Where you do have a stigma around depression, a stigma around suicide. This is a way of getting information and not feeling like you're exposing yourself, right? It's out there, it's reliable, it's in your language, it's a door.
Arriaga says the glossary has been years in the making in collaboration with UPIC speakers. The plan was to launch the project on November 1st, but when the remnants of the Typhoon Halon forced hundreds of people to evacuate to Anchorage, the organization decided to release it sooner.
The care and the healing of the folks who are here from Kipnuk and other villages is going to continue. So this is a resource that now can really be used in settings where they're going to be talking about different things that affect their mental health.
The organization is now looking for funding to complete a similar glossary, but for terms relevant for emergency care and intake. In Anchorage, I am Alona Naiden.
The National Congress of American Indians says it welcomes the reopening of the federal government to restore stability to critical services to tribes. In a statement, NCAI said during the shutdown, the Indian Health Service largely remained open due to advance appropriations, but it's depending on Congress to extend Affordable Care Act tax credits, and that reopening the government restores funding to food assistance programs that many Native people rely on. The organization says temporary fixes are not enough and that data collected from tribes during the shutdown made clear how long-term lasting solutions and structural funding reforms are needed to honor tribal trust and treaty obligations. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Next.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support from Clarkson Potter, publisher of Turtle Island, Foods and Traditions of the Indigenous Peoples of North America by Native American chef Sean Sherman. With ancestral and modern recipes, this cookbook showcases diverse foodways of the continent's regions. From comics to games to film and TV, Indigipop X is Native American popular culture. Everyone is welcome this weekend at Duke University in Durham, North Carolina. Info at indigipopx.com who support this show.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
Foundation at macfound.org.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California.
And I'm Scott Detrow in Washington. In Sudan, the paramilitary Rapid Support Forces now control the western region of Darfur. That's after the RSF finally took the city of El Fasher, the capital of North Darfur, after laying siege for over 500 days. The RSF has been fighting the Sudanese military for control of the entire country. Human rights groups now warn the violence and civilian suffering echo the Darfur genocide of two decades ago. The Sudanese journalist Nadia Taha is now based in Virginia. She has been closely watching the latest developments in Sudan's civil war. Her family has lived in Al-Fashir for generations. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Scott.
Let's start with what's happening now. What have you been hearing from the city since the RSF takeover in late October?
Al-Fashir in a very bad situation right now. Since October 27 and 28, a lot of civilians are trying to flee the city, some of them to reach Tuwila North Darfur. Some of them, they left to northern Sudan. And some civilians, they're still stuck in the middle in a place called Gurney. And a lot of civilians, especially the men, they are arrested by Rapid Support Force and they're asking for money to release them. I have three of my family members still now, we don't know where are they. The situation is really difficult, and a lot of people have seen what happened in Al-Fashir, how they've been massacring, killing a lot of people, and it was being documented by Rapid Support for armies, because civilians, they are not having way to document everything. Mm-hmm. But we've seen people we know, people we grow up with them in Al-Fashir being killed. And what I've seen in my life, I've never seen in Sudan, how people are killed, and the hospital of Al-Fashir, a Saudi hospital, we've seen how they massacre the hospital, including the patient. Mm-hmm. And I have one of our neighbor, he died in that hospital, and it's still his kid, they didn't find his body, and they are not able to even have a funeral because they don't know where their dad is. The situation is really difficult. I lost my brother Muhammad on September 24th.
Can you tell me about him?
He's older than me, 3 years older than me, and he's one of the nicest people in Al-Fashir. He's well known in Al-Fashir. We always, this is what we say in Arabic, that nice people, they don't live long. He's refusing to leave Al-Fashir. He was helping people to skip Al-Fashir. He was also one of the people who tried to find food to the people who are dying from hunger. And most of us, when we do fundraising or when I collect money from my colleague, I send it to him to help neighbors and stuff. He was died in a drone bomb in 24th of September with seven of his colleagues. Mm-hmm. It was heartbreaking for me. Yeah. I never had a pain like this in my life since my mom passed away in 2003, also part of Darfur War.
It's probably a difficult thing to think about, but can you tell us about the city, what the city was like before this violence, before this siege? What do you remember about growing up and living in Al-Fashir?
For me, growing up and living in Al-Fashir and going to the school and kindergarten, everyone is school. What I know is the people of the Fashir, they are really nice. When you walk in the street, everyone knows you. A city where it's very safe. I remember I traveled to Nairobi my first time leaving Sudan, and the landlord gave me a key. I was like, what is this thing? Because I never experienced a key for a house. In Al-Fashir, that's the only city we don't have keys for a house. We trust everyone to our houses.
It's brutally hard to be living in the city in this environment, but it's a different kind of hard to have this happening to your home and to be so far away. What has the last year been like for you being in the U.S. and seeing this, reading news about it, and getting whatever information as you can from your family and friends who are living in it?
Scott, when the war started there, I have a show, early morning show. Because of the time difference, I don't sleep. And I come back to work, I not sleep a whole night. And I used to tell all American who's my friend, I never drank coffee until the war started in El Fasher. Now every morning I can't open my house without having coffee. I am not sleeping. And actually, some people who they know me, when I open my hair, it's turned gray.
From your perspective, what do you want to see from the international community?
I need to have peace. The city has to be back. And also what I need, a justice for African people who are dying since 2003 until now. And what happening is for me is this is like an ethnic cleansing. I don't think I will ever go back to El Fasher because they will never allow me to go back to El Fasher. That's one of the things I'm really scared of because my city is not there anymore.
Mm-hmm. That is journalist Nadia Taha, who lives in the U.S. now, but is a native and spent much of her life in the city of Al Fasher. Thank you so much for talking to us.
Thank you for having me, Scott.
A word that started out more than three centuries ago as a medical diagnosis has today come to explain a complex set of emotions tied to longing. NPR's Word of the Week series explores the origin stories of common words. And this week, Scott Newman takes us down memory lane for the word nostalgia.
If you're looking for a bit of nostalgia, Ka-Chunk Records in Annapolis, Maryland is worth a stop. On a Saturday afternoon, owner Matt Mona sits at the register. He's just inside the doorway of the cramped storefront that features rack after rack of vinyl albums. Mona says he was pretty young when he got his introduction to what many now view as an obsolete technology.
I had like a Fisher-Price record player and He-Man records and Michael Jackson Thriller, Star Wars soundtrack.
For Mona, those memories are nostalgic. That word, though, nostalgia, dates from 1688, when a young medical student, Johannes Hofer, recorded physical symptoms accompanied by melancholy in Swiss mercenaries deployed away from home. Jess Zafaris is the author of Useless Etymology.
And he documented symptoms like fatigue and anxiety and heart palpitations and fevers and noted that when they went home, they felt better.
Zafaris says Hofer coined the word nostalgia from the Latin forms of the Greek words nostos, meaning homecoming, and algos, meaning pain.
Nostalgia has now evolved to mean far more than homesickness and sometimes not necessarily tied to a concept of a house or a home at all or a sense of place. It's more affiliated with a sense of time.
Author and historian Thomas Dodman says slowly, the word acquired a meaning closer to the one we know today.
From the late 18th century, I would say, onwards, it starts to acquire a sense of time to it, which is the way we think of nostalgia. But those two are very much intertwined for a very long time.
Yeah. Back at Ka-Chunk Records, one thing does seem peculiar. Most of the customers appear to be too young to have experienced the CD's heyday, let alone the LPs. Store owner Mona isn't surprised. Vinyl, he says, conjures up something that can't be streamed.
Well, anything that's tangible and tactile, it just sets off elements in your brain that really react and create memories.
For the customers at Ka-Chunk, the joy of rediscovering the past could someday become its own nostalgia. Scott Newman, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
You are tuned in to All Things Considered here on member-supported radio KAXE-KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. Coming up next is North Star Stories. Programming on KAXE-KBXE is supported in part by MinSure, offering Minnesotans the opportunity to find discounts, compare private health plans, and see if they qualify for no-cost or low-cost insurance. Expert advice is also available. The enrollment deadline is December 18th for coverage, starting January 1st. Information and enrollment are online at mnsure.org. Check out KXE.org for information about food-related resources across northern Minnesota, with hours of operation and locations of food shelves, along with information on soup kitchens and community meals. Add resources in your region by email, news@kaxe.org. Don't forget our question of the week. What do you remember about your home ec and shop classes? Text 218-326-1234.
You are listening to North Star Stories, Voices from Where We Live, a daily newscast about what it means to live in Minnesota.
In today's broadcast, another Minnesota-based company announces layoffs. Then, how some northern communities are supporting those affected by food shortages. And the federal government has a new rule for work permits. I'm Gracie J. Agribusiness giant Cargill says it will permanently lay off 80 employees in Minnesota as part of a global workforce reduction. Cargill is a multinational food corporation located in the western suburbs of the metro area. The company says the layoffs are not tied to automation. Affected workers will receive severance pay and job placement support at the end of the year. In recent weeks, major corporations, including Target, have announced mass layoffs. Next, in this month's report from the Northeast, the news director from Amper Station WTIP talks to Victor Palomino about how the Grand Marais community is organizing to support those affected by the conflicts at the federal level.
Many local governments, community members, and businesses are preparing to meet the growing need for food support. This includes communities in the northeastern Minnesota, where Kelly Hopkins is WTIP Radio's news director.
Our local Cook County Public Health and Human Services come forward and start preparing with additional resources and opportunities for those who are seeking those benefits. Another great thing that we've seen in our community is that a handful of our local business owners have also stepped forward.
Kelly says local coffee shops, grocery stores, and other businesses are offering gift cards and discounts to help people in need.
Basically being a resource in a spot in town where people can go to if they need a hot meal or if they need some food. And so it's been really great to see that kind of the synergy and the momentum in our community in the last week.
According to WTIP, Cook County officials and the county's Public Health and Human Services Department report that an average of 335 residents receive food benefits each month.
And that can range anywhere from as small as $23 a month that they receive. It could go all the way up to $1,158, just depending on factors such as income and household size.
WTIP also reports that county leaders say that they are working to support residents facing food insecurity through the coming months, regardless of what happens at the national level.
From right now until the end of the year, end of 2025, there will be a food drive set up in the lobby of our local Cook County Courthouse here.
Several collection bins will be set up for self-serve donations, where individuals can contribute unopened, non-expired, non-perishable food items.
It's also a place for individuals that need food to stop in, look through the bins, and select the items that they may need as well. So that'll be at the lobby of our Cook County Courthouse throughout the end of 2025.
In other WTIP news, construction is underway on an expansion for the Cook County Law Enforcement Center.
Yeah, so this is part of a larger capital improvement project with our county here, and this was approved back in August of 2023. So recently held a groundbreaking ceremony with a handful of county officials, the construction crews there as well, our Cook County sheriffs, but it's looking to address some safety issues, some space concerns there for the sheriff's department. Particularly, this expansion project will go to improve some evidence storage and then add a new sally port so that a ambulance can fit into that back area there within the law enforcement center.
Work will continue as long as the weather allows and is expected to be completed by next summer.
If you're looking to learn more about things happening, news happening along the North Shore here in the Northeast region, you can head over to WTIP.org.
For North Star Stories, I'm Victor Palomino.
You are You're listening to North Star Stories. The Department of Homeland Security, also known as DHS, has announced a new rule ending automatic extensions of work permits for most non-citizens. Starting last month, those renewing employment authorization must wait for DHS approval before their documents are extended. Officials say the change allows for more frequent background checks to detect fraud and protect national security. The rule does not affect extensions granted before the new policy takes effect.
North Star Stories is produced by Ambers, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities, with support from the McKnight Foundation and the state of Minnesota, online at ambers.org.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow.
And I'm Elsa Chang. Harvard University officials recently raised the alarm on grade inflation. A report last month found that more than half of all grades awarded to students were A's. That number has increased by 25% over the past two decades. Some say grades are creeping upwards because students have gotten soft and the standards for academic excellence are lower than they've ever been before. Well, Ian Bogost is a professor at Washington University in St. Louis and a contributing writer at The Atlantic. And he says the issue is a whole lot more complicated than simply students having thin skin. Welcome to All Things Considered.
Thank you so much for having me.
So can we get into why grades are going up and up and up, starting with the institutional factors that you discuss in your article? Like, why do universities feel incentivized to give students higher and higher grades?
So one reason, especially at schools like Harvard or at WashU where I teach, is the students have gotten a lot better. It's really hard to get into Harvard. And if it's harder to get in, that means the students are better. Maybe they deserve A's more. That's one reason. Mm-hmm. Another reason is that the work has changed. We've tried to modernize how the curriculum works. And, you know, just assignments are sometimes smaller. Maybe you're doing projects and things that are not different from exams or papers or that sort of thing. There's conditions of academic labor. About three quarters of faculty all across the country are non-tenured, their employment may be based in part on the evaluations that students give them. So there's an incentive for them to give higher grades because students love getting higher grades.
A little bit of old-fashioned bribery.
That's right. Huh? There's issues around anxiety and mental health concerns and universities' desires to address those, and certainly the performance that the pressure that students are under is very high. The cost of college has been rising, and that has turned students more into customers, and they say, well, I would like to perform.
Yeah,
well.
Explain that, because you argue that one factor that's playing into all of this is this broader trend of students transitioning from scholars into customers, as you put it, at universities. Talk more about that.
Yeah, it started with a desire to make sure that if you came to college and you were spending money, that you were going to graduate, you were going to get something out of the experience. And a whole regime that's sometimes called student success was launched. But as we started competing more and more for students on the intangibles, you know, the nice dorms and the pretty campuses and the facilities and all of the rest, the student success expanded. And, you know, it started to include wellness and satisfaction and other aspects of kind of lifestyle marketing almost. And all of that means that when you're at college and you're spending, you know, $100,000 a year, in some cases, that it's impossible for the situation not to become one that's more customer-like. And faculty have, they've responded. You can't help but think, well, they're paying a lot of money for this. And, I want to grade them hard or at least fairly. But you also understand that they believe that they're getting something back.
Well, let me ask you about your personal experience as a professor. You have taught in the humanities, you have taught in computer science, so you have
That's
this
right.
large range of student-professor relationship experience. And I'm curious what you've noticed in terms of, have you seen students' attitudes towards grades shift over the years, over your own academic career?
Right. I've been teaching for more than 20 years now, and I think the biggest general shift I have seen across all of the fields in which I teach is that the students want to know exactly what they need to do to get an A.
How will you evaluate me?
That's right. That's right.
I mean, I relate
to that. And that's a fair question.
Yeah.
It's a fair question. Yeah. The problem is that part of the assessment of a student is making them come to the table and figure out what it is that we're asking for. So when I say, I want you to do this assignment, if I have to tell them exactly what to do to perform, then they're missing the opportunity to complete the assignment in the way that I've designed it. I want them to think about the question or the project or the written assignment or even the coding project that I've given them, and bring something to the table from their own heads and their own experience.
So is grade inflation something that should be resolved and done away with? What do you think?
I think it's more like a symptom of a bigger problem. You know, when the grades are going up, but the level of performance or mastery that the grade is meant to measure is not going up, that does seem like a problem that we should address. Mm-hmm. But you have to fix all these other conditions that are at work.
Yeah.
Some of them are really complicated. You know, one that I talk about in this Atlantic piece is the accreditation system. The way that we measure ourselves in order to be able to grant degrees by these regulating organizations, that's also impacted how we grade. You can't like unwind that stuff just by giving more Bs or something like that.
Right.
You have to solve those problems at the place that they happen.
So we just kind of throw up our hands and go, oh, well.
No, I mean, we
80% of people are going to get A's now next year.
Right, right. I don't think that that's the answer either. But I think the first step toward an answer is recognizing that this sort of idea that either the students are lazy or the professors are soft, it's just not true. That's not what's really happening.
Ian Bogost, professor at Washington University in St. Louis, thank you very much for joining us today.
Oh, thank you so much.
Two different holidays collide on this week's Billboard charts as Michael Jackson sets an all-time record. NPR's Stephen Thompson has the story.
Before the streaming era, holidays didn't usually affect Billboard's Hot 100 singles chart. You'd get an occasional seasonal novelty hit, but for the most part, December's charts didn't look much different from the charts in, say, March. Streaming has changed that in a big way. The December charts are wall-to-wall Christmas, July 4th brings a chart surge for patriotic music, and Halloween streaming has made chart perennials out of old hits by the likes of Rockwell, Bobby Boris Pickett, and Ray Parker Jr.
Something strange in the neighborhood. Who you gonna call?
The biggest beneficiary of this Halloween surge has been the estate of Michael Jackson. His song Thriller has become a staple of spooky playlists, and this week it zooms all the way back up to number 10, more than 40 years after its release. Despite many listeners' complicated relationship with Jackson, Thriller has returned to the charts many times over the years. But its return to the top 10 has triggered a major milestone. Michael Jackson is now the only artist in history to score a top 10 hit in six separate decades. And he's done it in seven decades if you count his work in the Jackson 5. I Want You Back first hit the top 10 in the very last chart of the 1960s. By this time next week, Thriller will have likely fallen out of the top 10. After all, we're well into November, which means that spooky season is fully behind us. But there's something even scarier lurking in the depths of this week's Hot 100. A different old song re-enters this week's chart at number 31. Terrifying us all by arriving earlier than ever, it's Mariah Carey with All I Want for Christmas Is You.
The foulest stench is in the air, the funk of 40,000 years.
Stephen Thompson, NPR Music.
Are closing in to seal your doom. And though you fight to stay alive, your body starts to shiver. For no mere mortal can resist.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from Progressive Insurance, Progressive is looking for dedicated and forward-thinking individuals to join their growing team. More information, including application, at progressive.com/careers. From The Economist, in a world of rapid change, The Economist seeks to cut through the noise, to offer insight into what matters now and what's coming next. Daily global reporting, podcasts, and videos at economist.com/NPR. And from Workday. Workday is an AI platform for forward thinkers, dedicated to transforming the way business leaders manage people, money, and agents today so they can transform tomorrow. Workday, moving business forever forward.
This is 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley Bemidji, 89.9 Brainerd, and on your smart speaker, we are People Powered Radio in Northern Minnesota. Join us at KAXE.org. Support for KAXE comes from Timberlake Restaurant, offering fresh baked popovers, crafted cocktails, and menu items such as walleye a la Ritz or chicken Kiev. Information about the dinner menu is available at TimberlakeLodgeHotel.com. Happy Dancing Turtle hosts a holiday and seasonal decor swap Saturday, November 15th from 9 to noon at their office in Pine River. Items may include lights, tablecloths, gift wrap, and other decorations. If you would like to drop off items, they'll be accepted from 8 to noon Friday, November 14th. You do not need to donate items to take items. Weather tonight, mostly clear skies, lows 29 to 34 degrees. Tomorrow, mostly sunny with highs 54 to 60. South winds 10 to 20 miles per hour. Evening lows in the mid-30s, low 40s.
Canceling one flight has a domino effect. They've had to move different actual airports.